Listeners, some of you may already know that my mom recently passed away. She was at her house, and it happened while she was sleeping. I have gotten many, many, many condolences and well wishes from listeners and from other podcasters. Thank you for that. And one way that I have decided to thank you is by releasing this episode. Kit Karen and I recorded this near the end of the second week of April. And the next day, I began working on editing it because our goal at the time was to release 2 episodes in April, since we had only released 1 episode in March. And I was mostly done with editing when my mom unexpectedly passed away on the morning of April 16th. And long story short, I recently decided to complete the editing and to release the episode now. So please be aware that at the beginning, you will hear us talking about things that were affecting us then, such as being stuck at home because of the virus situation. There will be no mention of my mom passing away, because that didn't happen until a few days later. Although, you will probably notice that some of our comments are weirdly and ironically relevant to both situations. I also want to give you a heads up that the episode is approximately a 50-50 mixture of lighthearted and tragic things, which is also a pretty good description of my brain right now. Oh, one last thing. Because of the virus situation at the time, I needed to record in a different place than usual, so the audio quality and volume on this episode is occasionally uneven. I apologize in advance for that. And with all that having been said, here is episode 38 of the Forgotten News Podcast.
You are listening to the Forgotten News Podcast.
But before we begin, here are a few words about a couple of other podcasts that we think you might want to try.
Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we're the hosts of Eat Crime, a podcast full of delicious mysteries.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Eat Crime and on Facebook, Eat Crime Pod.
Here's a few examples of what you'll hear.
Laurencia and Bambi Bembenak.
Do what now?
And he had like secretly taken that copy. I don't know why.
I know why.
To murder her?
For murder.
And I was like, I can't imagine a mom naming their kids Dante. We're not in a satanic cult. So.
Yes, I don't know. Let's make that abundantly clear.
She seems like she... Provocativity? Is that a word?
She provocativity? Which, I mean, what a business, man.
I know. That's what I'm
murder
saying.
Murder people like, and got paid for it. It's both true that there is a Conjuring 2, and Conjuring 2 is true. Valerie, get out of here.
As of July 4th, 2019, our great nation turned 243 years old. I ask myself a question. I wonder what was the last lynching that occurred in each state. Once I began my search to find the answer to this question, I discovered how little others knew about the practice of lynching people in America, and Freedom Speaks Podcast was born. I am your host, Craig Woodall. Although the number of blacks lynched is far greater than any other race, there are other races represented in the total tally of lynchings in America. Freedom Speaks podcast is not solely a look into crimes against blacks, but rather a look into true crimes against humanity. Maya Angelou said, "History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again." Join us every other Monday as we tell these stories. Find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and wherever you get your podcasts. Search Freedom Speaks Podcast. You can also visit our website, which is freedomspeakspodcast.com. Subscribe, rate, review. You'll be glad you did, and so will we.
Welcome to the Forgotten News Podcast. This is your window to hear true stories from long ago. Stories that once made headlines. Stories that people thought would be unforgettable. Yet those stories were soon lost in the sands of time or were buried deep in the dustbin of history. In this podcast, we shake off the sand and dust from those stories and share them here with you, as fresh as the day they were first told.
And now, here's your hosts.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim.
Hey there. This is Kit Karen. Welcome to episode 38 of the Forgotten News Podcast.
Oh, man.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to start by saying, wow, the world has totally changed in the relatively short time since our previous episode. The coronavirus pandemic has turned everything upside down.
Yep. I haven't been out of my house except to go to the store to buy groceries or cleaning products, or to walk the dog, or to practically go on a safari in search of paper towels and toilet paper.
Honestly, I have left the house probably once. My roommate has done the majority of the shopping, which is wonderful. It has been crazy, though. I'm not going to work, and so that has been stressful. But yeah, it's just completely crazy and sad, and honestly, I hope things get back to normal, or relatively normal soon. And I hope that everybody stays safe, and everybody who has it gets better. This is just a crazy, crazy time in the world.
And by the way, Kit and I are practicing extremely safe social distancing in regard to recording this podcast.
Yes, not only are we not in the same room, we're not even in the same state.
So you don't need to worry about us at all.
We will be just fine.
Well, for me personally, in the situation of this current crisis, the really great thing about having this podcast is that it gives me something to do besides staring at the wall or zoning out in front of the TV.
Oh, this podcast definitely gives me something to do. It's a little bit hard just because everybody is at home during this time, and so finding the time to record can be difficult. But luckily, right now, the roommate's out fishing, and so he might be gone for a little while. And I think if we have an interesting story, or if the episode is something fun, then it helps to prevent our brain from turning into mush. And that is definitely a good thing.
Well, if nothing else, I hope that this podcast will help our listeners to think about something other than the current crisis.
At least for the length of an episode.
I think that will be our goal throughout the duration of the crisis. I've heard some podcasters wonder about what effect the crisis is going to have on podcasts. Like, for example, asking, with the world metaphorically on fire, are people still going to listen to podcasts? Well, in my opinion, yes, they are. Because people still have to do all of their day-to-day stuff. And listening to podcasts helps to pass the time while you wash the dishes or do laundry or whatever else you need to do.
I definitely agree with you. But, listeners, be careful, because with some podcasts, especially true crime podcasts, and sometimes even this podcast, you definitely want to use headphones, earbuds, or ear pods, depending on who might be standing or sitting nearby.
Now, listeners, please, just do yourself a favor. Listen to the experts. Listen to science. Because that way, you'll be safe. And you'll stay safe.
And listeners, if you are somebody who thinks this is all overblown, well, okay, fine. You're entitled to your opinion, but why take a chance? So, just stay in your house or apartment, wash your hands, and don't go out unless you're running out of food, cleaning supplies, or some other essential item.
Yes, absolutely.
And in the meantime, just do what you can to have fun and make the best of it. And by the way, I know that there are a lot of people that are upset because of all the events and other things that have been canceled. But you know what is not canceled? Love, laughter, family time, game shows, reading,
board games, puzzles, online games,
audiobooks,
music, YouTube,
podcasts,
television, radio, Netflix, and Hulu.
Take your dog for a walk.
So, listeners, you still have all of those things. And I say, make the most of it.
And I think we should help as many people as we can just to focus on something other than what's going on outside so they don't lose their mind. Because we all need to stay sane, and hopefully this is just another way to do it.
Yes. And now, on that note, let's move on.
Listeners, I'm going to share some very good advice written by a stonemason during the 16th century. In time, take time. While time does rest, for time is no time when time is past.
I think that is some excellent advice. And on that note, let's move on to our featured story. But as much as we would like for you to listen, we are first going to give you a short warning about the story so that you can decide for yourself if you want to continue to listen or not.
Now, On this episode, you will hear the story of a rather brutal murder that took place in New York City in 1887, and the aftermath of that murder. It is generally believed that this incident was the first time in the United States in which a killer attempted to hide his crime by stuffing his dead victim into a trunk and then attempting to dispose of it.
Now, there is a lot more to this story than that. However, we are pretty certain that it is more than enough information to enable you to decide if you want to listen to the whole story.
But we will definitely keep the gory details to the absolute minimum, while still telling you the story in a historically accurate way. Now, listeners, if you think that hearing about these things could possibly cause you to have a negative emotional reaction, then this episode might not be something that you should listen to. In addition, the story that is being featured is absolutely not recommended for children, since it could be upsetting or even frightening to young ears. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
And now, with all of that having been said, and if you are ready,
on with the show! Listeners, in a way, this is a story about a gamble. And here is what I mean by that. If a man gambles with a deck of cards, his luck might run for hours. If a woman risks her neck by trying to race across a railroad track ahead of a speeding train, her luck might last for less than a minute. But no one can set a time limit on how long your luck will run if you're trying to get away with murder. Listeners, our featured story on this episode will be told by a guest narrator.
But the identity of this narrator will not be revealed until after the end of the story, in order not to distract from the story itself.
And on that note, here is the featured story.
In the spring of 1865, a man named Edward Unger had recently returned to New York City as a veteran of the American Civil War. He had not only fought in a dozen bloody battles as a member of the 11th New York Infantry, but he had risen to the rank of captain and received the Medal of Honor for heroic actions on the front lines. But 2 decades later, his life was very different. He was now barely earning a living as the owner of a small saloon in the Bowery District. The place was a dive. His usual patrons were mainly drunks, pickpockets, cheap prostitutes, card game tricksters, and similar disreputable characters. But other customers were attracted by his staff of 4 or 5 female employees. These were teenage girls who would wear very snug, bright red blouses and something called, quote, Turkish harem pants, unquote, which were made of extremely thin white cloth, through which the legs of the girls were visible to anyone nearby whenever the barroom was filled with light, such as on a sunny day or in the evening from gas lamps. The girls would take and serve orders for drinks or food from patrons sitting at tables. but their primary job was to try to coax the male customers into buying them drinks. Each time they were successful, Unger would pay them 1/3 of the price of the drink. They were paid entirely on the basis of this commission system, rather than wages. It was a perfectly legal hustle, which sold alcohol to men, sometimes large quantities of alcohol, by leading them to believe that they were buying something more. However, the mere fact that Unger needed to resort to these unscrupulous and degrading practices simply in order to turn a profit, well, it clearly shows just how far he had fallen in the years since he had returned to New York City. In October of 1886, he placed an advertisement in a newspaper looking for a business partner to help turn things around. A man named August Bollé responded. Bollé was a handsome German immigrant. He had made a small fortune in the Chicago stockyards, butchering cattle and selling sausage. Together, Bollé and Unger concocted a scheme to make and sell sausages that would be secretly made from cheap horse meat. Bollé put up the money for the plan. And in turn, Unger gave Bollé free room and board in his home at 22 Ridge Street. But unfortunately for both Unger and Bollé, the horse sausage scheme was unsuccessful. In fact, it was so unsuccessful that Unger was forced to sell his saloon to pay debts and avoid lawsuits. The two men were both still living in the same house. Unger tolerated this arrangement because Bollé was now paying rent, since Unger could no longer afford to give him free lodging. He hated the fact that the rent he received from Bollé was now his only source of income. Bollé, in return, hated the fact that he was now having to pay rent or be put on the street. So, for these reasons, among others, there was an extremely high level of toxic emotional tension between Unger and Bollé. This mutual hostility finally boiled over on the night of January 20th, 1887, after an evening of heavy drinking. It was a bitter cold night, and Bollé could not sleep. He growled about the cold until Unger agreed to light the fireplace. However, even after the fire was lit, Bollé continued to complain. A shoving match began. Bollé grabbed a carving knife that was laying on a nearby table. Unger became frightened and looked around the room for a weapon to protect himself. He saw a hammer, and the fight ended after Unger got a hold of the hammer and smashed Bollé in the head. Unger later described what had happened.
Suddenly, I became possessed of a desire to kill. I struck him with all my strength on the head. The hammerhead sank out of sight in his skull. The blood and brain that flew only added to my frenzy. I struck him again after he lay dead on the sofa.
A few moments later, Unger realized what he had done. His first impulse was to flee, which he did, until he realized that he had to go back to dispose of the body. He decided that he would tell anyone who asked that Bollé had gone back to Germany. Unger knew that his teenage son and his 7-year-old daughter would soon be returning home from school, so he had to act quickly. He rolled the body under his bed and hid it inside his room until morning. He did this notwithstanding the fact that, at the same time, Unger and his son were sharing the same bed at night because of Bollé renting the room. The next morning, after the children had left for school, Unger went out and bought a saw and a rubber tarp. Then, after he came back, he hacked off Bollé's head. He immediately felt sick to his stomach from the sight of the dead man's open eyes, but he gave himself some liquid courage by taking a few shots of whiskey. He then finished the work that he needed to do. He cut the body into small pieces and stuffed them into an old trunk, which had belonged to Bollé. However, he did not put the head in the trunk. Instead, he wrapped it in old clothing and newspapers and put it inside a dresser drawer. Unger then took the trunk to a shipping company where he gave a fake address for it to be delivered in Baltimore. He then bought a ticket for the Williamsburg Ferry and dropped the bundled head into the river when nobody was looking. Unger later said that he slept easy that night because he was certain that his wrongdoing could never be discovered. However, like most people who think they have committed the perfect crime, he overlooked one small but important detail. He forgot dead meat eventually begins to release a bad smell. And in this case, that happened after the trunk had sat in the freight office in Baltimore for 3 days. Since no one had shown up to claim the trunk and the stench had become overpowering, it was ordered to be open. The workers then look inside. They were stunned at what they saw. A headless human torso with the legs and feet cut off, along with a bloody pile of clothing all lumped together within the trunk. Foul play was suspected. The police in Baltimore asked the New York City police to take charge of the case because the trunk had come from there. The challenge was immediately accepted by Inspector Thomas Burns, the chief of the Detective Bureau of the New York City Police Department, after receiving a telegram from the chief of police of Baltimore. Inspector Burns almost couldn't believe what he was reading. He later recalled,
"A headless body. That was certainly a novelty, and I became greatly interested."
By a random coincidence, Burns and Unger actually knew each other. They had fought side by side during the war as members of the 11th New York Infantry, and both men had risen to the rank of captain. But they had each later traveled on extremely different paths. Burns would go on to become the most famous police detective of the 19th century. But in contrast, Unger became one of the most infamous murders of the century. It did not take long for the police to connect the death to Unger. And only 2 days after the discovery of the body in the trunk, he was in custody. Inspector Burns had simply looked through the clothing of the victim and found a business card with his name. He traced the man to the home where he had lived. Detectives went inside the house at 22 Ridge Street and saw traces of blood nearly everywhere. It was on the walls, the carpets, the chair, the floor, and in two buckets. There was also a knife, a hammer, and most disturbingly, a saw. Unger had no money for a lawyer, because at the time of his arrest, he was living below the poverty line. However, throughout most of the 19th century, it was customary in New York that if a poor person was charged with a felony, that the judge would assign a lawyer, chosen at random, to represent the defendant. And in this case, it was attorney William Howe who got the call. This was an incredible stroke of luck for Unger, because William Howe was the most skilled and the most successful criminal defense lawyer in New York. He was particularly successful in jury trials. He had a unique ability to take the weakest part of an accused criminal's defense and somehow transform it into a battering ram against the prosecution. And, a few years later, in the 1890s, possibly for these reasons, his law firm, Howe and Hummel, represented nearly 90% of all felony defendants in the city of New York. William Howe was an immigrant from England who had arrived in the U.S. when he was in his early 20s. He never lost his Cockney accent. His nickname was Big Bill. This came from the fact that he was 6 feet tall and weighed over 300 pounds, 136 kilograms in the metric system. His early years are shrouded in mystery. The only thing that is known for certain is that he began studying law very soon after his arrival in New York and became a lawyer after fulfilling all the requirements for admission to the bar. And throughout the rest of his life, for various reasons, he was always viewed as being somewhat of a shady character. But for now, we will return to 1887 and the appointment of Mr. Howe as the lawyer for Edward Unger. The first thing that happened was that, almost immediately after he learned that he had been appointed, he rushed to the jail and told Unger to keep his mouth shut and admit nothing. No matter what they say or promise, don't tell the cops anything. When he felt certain that Unger understood these instructions, Howe left to begin preparing the case. But unfortunately, this was one time that Big Bill had seriously underestimated the determination of Inspector Burns and the New York City Detective Bureau. Burns had a very strong belief that
"It is not remorse that makes the criminal confess. It is anxiety, mental strain."
So, to get a confession from Unger, he spent the next several days putting him through, basically, psychological torture. First, the inspector brought in, one by one, various people who could implicate Unger. For example, the neighbor who saw him carrying buckets, the storekeepers who sold the rubber sheet that wrapped the body, the hardware clerk that sold him the hammer. Burns merely had them walk silently near enough to the cell where Unger was incarcerated for him to see them. Burns later had Unger come to his office. He showed him the hammer covered with dried blood, the saw with bloody teeth, and the blood-soaked rubber sheet. And for each item, Burns simply asked Unger,
"How much did you pay for this?"
Unger denied buying it. Burns repeated the question two more times. Unger denied the purchase each time. Burns shook his head disgustedly, then sent him back to his cell. Later the same afternoon, Burns had two of his detectives take the terrible trunk and place it in the hallway directly across from Unger's cell. He then had them take the sofa on which Bollet had died and bring it to the waiting room of the detective bureau. Burns then had Unger brought to his office, where he took out each bloody article of clothing and calmly asked Unger,
"Do you know anything about this? What about this? Or this?"
Each time, Unger said he knew nothing. Burns then walked Unger to the waiting room, where he was told to sit down. He sat, but then a few seconds later, he jumped back up when he realized what it was that he was sitting on. At this point, Burns told Unger that he was sending him back to his cell, but to let him know if he had changed his mind. He was willing to hear the truth, but only the truth. 2 hours later, Unger did change his mind. He sent a message that he wanted to talk to Inspector Burns. He told Burns that he had killed August Bollet, but it was in self-defense. He said that he did not intend to kill. However, when he realized that the man was dead, he hid the body because his son would be coming home shortly. Now, in the 1880s, the courts would occasionally be pretty serious about the right of a defendant to a speedy trial. So only 2 weeks later, Unger was on trial for his life. The details of the case were so sickening that nearly everyone who had read or heard about the case simply assumed that Unger would be found guilty of murder and then be on his way to the hangman. But when the trial actually began, Unger made an unexpectedly good impression. He had a strong and very masculine presence, which was only enhanced when the courtroom learned about his past as a veteran and a war hero. So when he began to tell his story on the witness stand, the jury was riveted. According to a newspaper article in the New York Herald, Unger gave his testimony in a vocal style that was almost theatrical. Quote, "He cried, he laughed, he sighed, he whispered, he shouted. He exemplified the emotions of love, hate, fear, remorse, terror, despair, hope. And he did all of this where it should be done, and with telling effect. He held his audience spellbound from beginning to end." End quote. At one point, the judge allowed him to rise from his chair and act out the way in which he had fought off the alleged attack of Bollet. Unger ended his testimony by telling the jury about his regret and remorse for the terrible thing he had done. Then finally, with deep sadness in his eyes, he said,
"I'm a miserable, miserable man."
All of these things worked in favor of Unger, together with something else, which definitely helped to turn the tide. Unger had two very pretty daughters, Anna, who was 18, and little Emily, who was 7. They both loved their father dearly and came to court every day, sitting on each side of him at the defense table. Emily had curly blonde hair and bright blue eyes. She spent most of her time simply being adorable, snuggling up to Unger, and frequently sitting on his lap. However, the most memorable aspect of the trial occurred when attorney William Howe gave his closing argument. At first, he did not challenge any of the facts that had been presented by the prosecution. Instead, he talked about Unger's remorse and argued that the killing and its aftermath had been justified, and not only justified, but excusable. He spoke about how Unger had hid the body under his bed for fear that his young son would see it. He exclaimed to the jury,
"They slept over the dead body, it is true, but what a night it must have been for Unger."
Attorney Howe described Unger as a good man who had been pushed to violence because violence was being done to him, and thus, in a very real sense, it was not his fault. Yet, Unger was now on trial, and that was the real tragedy of the case. However, at this point, Big Bill was just warming up. He turned and looked directly at the jury. He then said,
"Gentlemen of the jury, Edward Unger did not cut the dead man's head off. He did not mutilate and dismember the body. He did not throw the head from the ferry boat under the paddle wheels. He did not put the dilapidated and mangled trunk in a box and send it to Baltimore."
Mr. House suddenly stopped talking, the judge and the jury and the spectators all seemed paralyzed by this statement. There were audible gasps in the courtroom because Unger had already admitted to doing all of these terrible things. But now, after working the jury up to this great state of excitement and expectancy, Mr. Howe turned his eyes fully upon Unger, who sat with little Emily on his knees. She was then happily playing with her father's gray hair and mustache. Howe now went for the big finish. He pointed at the child, and after a short pause, he began to speak.
"Look at that little girl. She cut off that head. She mutilated that body. It was that child that used the saw. It was not Unger. Yes, 'twas she. 'Twas she. Mr. Unger could not bear the thought of having it said with that beautiful girl living that he, her father, had committed so horrible a deed. Therefore, when in a moment it occurred to him that he could hide the deed which had been perpetrated, he mutilated the body. It was the thought of that little girl which caused him to do it, and therefore I'll say it was she that did it, not him. He expected her foot to come to his room, and so to hide from her innocent gaze the awful spectacle. His mind set in motion by the recollection of the child commanded these horrible acts. Gentlemen of the jury, did you leave your homes to hang a man upon your inference? Would you take the defendant away from his children and lock him up for life in a living tomb? God forbid. God forbid.
The daughters of Unger wept loudly as they cuddled their father during Howe's powerful argument. The combined effect in court of tiny Emily, of William Howe's tear-stained face, together with his theatrical voice, was electrifying. The jury was clearly swayed by all of it. Nevertheless, it is a good rule of thumb for people who desire to dispose of troublesome lodgers not to chop them into little pieces. There was probably no jury anywhere that could have been convinced to ignore that, notwithstanding the verbal gymnastics of the best criminal defense lawyer in New York City. And so, Unger was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 20 years in prison. Nevertheless, this verdict was considered to be an incredible victory for William Howe, since he had been able to save Unger from the hangman's noose. It was a verdict that almost no one had thought possible prior to the trial. The prosecutor later commented on Howe's performance. He called it, quote, "the finest piece of acting I have ever heard of in a murder trial," end quote. Big Bill passed away in 1902 at age 75. He was asked shortly before his death as to what he attributed his frequent success with juries. He responded,
"I kept in touch with human nature. I appealed to the jurors as human beings. I endeavored to bring them close in touch with human weakness and human frailties. When I had a desperate case, I tried to make each juror stand in the position of the prisoner when he committed the crime, so as to make the hearts of the jurors boil with the same temptations that actuated the person to feel as he did. When I had done that, the rest was easy, for human nature is the same at all times, in all ages."
Now, getting back to Edward Unger, there's a little more to his story. He was sent to serve his sentence in Sing Sing Prison in New York, located on the east bank of the Hudson River. And in the 19th century, it was the home to some of the most notorious and violent prisoners in the world of crime. It is no wonder that there were numerous men who plotted to escape. However, after his arrival, Edward Unger was not among those who attempted to flee. He needed a different type of escape. Specifically, a way to escape from the ghost of the man he had killed. According to Unger, the haunting began on his first night at Sing Sing. He was awakened from his sleep and saw the remains of his dismembered victim, August Bollet, on the floor as a pile of ghostly body parts. A moment later, the parts began to slowly reassemble right in front of him. Unger shrieked, and the phantom then instantly disappeared. Every night for a week, the apparition appeared. First, the several limbs would appear on the floor of his cell, and then other body parts. Each of these fragments would then begin to quiver. After this, the parts would move slowly toward each other, almost like slithering snakes, and arrange themselves into human form. This terrifying chain of events would eventually reach a climax, where Unger could no longer stand it, and he would burst into terrified screaming. Unger was eventually sent to the prison doctor, to whom he described his nightly encounter with the ghost of the murdered man.
But the head is missing. At length that too comes into the room. With a horrible smile on his face, it places itself on its shoulders.
By the end of Unger's first week at Sing Sing, he had become nearly completely delirious and was so frail and emaciated that he was transferred to the prison infirmary. In fact, Unger was so far gone that the doctor had decided that if there was no improvement by the end of the following week, he would be sent to the state asylum for criminal lunatics. But almost like a miracle during that week, the hauntings came to a sudden stop, and Unger was practically a new man. During his time in prison, he was employed in the kitchen, where he was, quote, unquote, one of the best cooks, as well as one of the best prisoners, according to the warden. In June 1899, he was released from prison 7 years before the end of his sentence for good behavior. Edward Unger kept up his good behavior for the rest of his life. And not only that, he was consulted for advice by the New York police whenever a trunk murder happened to occur. Ironically, because of the national publicity surrounding the murder committed by Unger, there were now many killers who thought they could hide their crime by hacking their victims into pieces, then stuffing them into trunks to be shipped away to distant places. They all evidently thought that they could get away with it, notwithstanding that Unger did not. But in nearly every case, the perfect crime that they thought they were committing turned out to be the opposite of perfect. However, despite these gruesome situations, on which he was often consulted by police, he was never again plagued by nightmares or ghosts. But thankfully, it is beyond doubt that those horrifying visions, which had been seen by Edward Unger in his prison cell, were the key thing that led to him changing his life into a positive direction forever.
Honestly, that story had everything but the kitchen sink. Seriously, here we have a Civil War hero. He returns home to New York after the war and opens a bar. And honestly, not just an ordinary bar, but it sounds like an 1880s version of Hooters. But then a few years later, the bar goes downhill and eventually becomes a dive. So to try to turn things around, he finds a business partner, and they come up with some crazy plan to make money by selling the public cheap horse meat disguised to look like regular meat. Ugh.
Sausages.
But when the plan doesn't work out, which of course it wouldn't, the two of them have a falling out, and one ends up killing the other one? Sounds like a Lifetime movie. He cuts him up and tries to hide it. We always know this is going to end up badly. And right away, he gets suspected and arrested, because he obviously did not do a good job of trying to hide the murder. I mean, number one, who wouldn't clean the house as soon as they, dismembered a body? Seriously. Then he gets hounded into confessing by a totally obsessed police detective who he knew. And by sheer luck, he gets a lawyer who almost gets him off by trying to pin the blame on a 7-year-old girl. Oh my gosh. However, he ends up going to prison, where he is tormented by the ghost of his victim. Surprise, surprise. But eventually, he pulls himself together and becomes a model prisoner. And after he is released, he becomes a semi-official advisor to the police. So strange.
It was a wild, weird, topsy-turvy story.
It was one of the strangest true crime stories that I have ever heard.
And how about that police detective who went after Unger with all that psychological torture until he confessed?
Inspector Thomas Burns. He was the most famous police detective in America at the time.
He used every publicity gimmick that he could think of to create a reputation for himself of being able to use science or psychology to solve any crime.
It wasn't really true, but his primary underlying goal was to lower the crime rate by intimidating professional criminals into believing that they couldn't get away with whatever crime they were thinking of committing.
And in regard to Edward Unger and the trunk murder, Inspector Burns just couldn't resist doing whatever he needed to do to crack the case.
Yes.
The entire thing was just so crazy. And there had never been a trunk murder before this one.
This story, beginning to end, was just an incredible chain of events.
But I will tell you one more thing in regard to the chain of events. It brought to mind, my mind, a quote from a short story written in 1927 called The Secret of Flambeau. The story takes place in England, and there is a scene in which a Catholic priest is explaining to some people about why he often has compassion for criminals. And this is what he says.
You may think a crime horrible because you could never commit it. I think it horrible because I could commit it.
Well, listeners, the reason that I happen to think of that quote is because, as horrible as the crime was that was committed by Edward Unger, you can never be too sure of what horrible thing you or I or anyone might do if something were to happen in our lives that would push us to the breaking point. And I think that is my final comment regarding this entire story.
I don't know what else we can say.
Well, me neither.
Okay then, let's just move on and thank our guest narrator and guest voices. So, just take a bow, one at a time, with appropriate social distancing from each other. And tell our audience anything that you would like them to know about you.
This is Aaron, and I'm your host, Devil We Know.
This is Mike Hatchley. I'm the narrator for the podcast Dice Tower Theater, a high fantasy story based on a basement tabletop role-playing game. You can find us at Dice Tower, theatre.com.
Hi, this is Jerry Kokich. I'm a voice actor who's always working on my craft. My email address, should you wish to contact me, is jerrykokich@yahoo.com.
You can also find me on Facebook.
And I have a website at jerrykokichvoiceactor.weebly.com. Y'all have a nice day now.
Thank you once more, everyone.
Absolutely. Thanks again. You guys always make our stories rock.
Next, listeners, in just a moment, we will move on to the segment that we know a lot of you look forward to, police blotter and court news. However, first, we are going to take a moment to mention that because of the current coronavirus situation, and also because of a lot of other difficult things that are going on in our personal lives, the Forgotten News podcast needs your help.
And the help we need is financial. We hate to beg, but we absolutely need to beg. Listeners, if you are someone who is lucky enough to have a job or income that is solid, please contribute to this podcast. Not only to help us out, but because it lets us know that our listeners really, truly want us to continue.
And the truth is, we absolutely want to keep this show going because we have some great stories that we really want to tell and that we think you would really enjoy.
However, unfortunately, we don't know how to live on just the nutrients in the atmosphere. We need to eat and drink, not only in order to survive, but to keep ourselves to be cheerful enough to continue to produce new episodes. And in addition, it costs us time and money to produce and release those episodes. So, for all of these reasons, we need you to help us out.
Even a dollar or two would be greatly appreciated.
Listeners, here's how to make a contribution.
And we have made it really easy for you to do it.
Just go to the address bar of your computer, laptop, or whatever device that you are using and type paypal.me/forgottennewspodcast.
paypal.me/forgottennewspodcast.
But type that as if it were all one word. Then contribute whatever amount you want.
$1, $5, $10.
Whatever you can afford. And we will be incredibly thankful.
In fact, we will give you a shout out on the first episode after you contribute, unless you tell us not to.
But if you're someone who would like to get something tangible in exchange for your money, then here is another option for you. Go to teepublic.com, that is teepublic.com, and use the search bar to look for Forgotten News. Then, ta-da! There are some really cool t-shirts, mugs, stickers, bags, and other things with our logo. So, go buy something, okay?
And we will get a percentage of the purchase price. It's a very small percentage, but every penny helps. Seriously, it really does.
Well, anyway, there you have it. Two different ways that you can help the Forgotten News podcast to stay alive and thrive.
And thank you, listeners, for doing that.
Now, as promised, we will move on to the latest edition of our regular segment, Police Blotter and Court News, in which we bring you stories of small-time crooks and other random folks who, for one reason or another, ended up in the machinery and pain of the justice system 100 or more years ago. And this particular segment will be narrated for you exactly as it was written in a column published on March 17th, 1889, in the Missouri Weekly Register, written in the words of the unknown reporter who wrote it. By the way, just as a historical note, I will mention that this newspaper no longer exists. It seems to have gone out of business at some point in the late 1890s. Now, if you are a regular listener, you know that on this segment, we typically feature a list of maybe a dozen or so tiny tales of true crime published in a column after the local court issued a sentence or made some other ruling in regard to their case.
But sometimes we feature a column that tells only one story.
And this is one of those times. It is the story of a teenage girl and her crime and punishment. But as usual, before we begin, we will give you a brief warning. Listeners, this is a story of a theft. But it was a very serious type of theft in the 19th century. You will hear about the trial of this girl and the aftermath of the trial. Now, listeners, one more thing. We often mention this, but I will say it again because it is important for overall context. Please be aware that it was very common in the 19th century for reporters or editors to mix their own opinions into the news articles that they published. And this particular story is a perfect example of that. We just want to make sure that you are aware of that because we will be presenting this news column verbatim, just as it was originally published.
So, with that information having been given, if you think that hearing about any of these things could possibly cause you to have a negative emotional reaction, then perhaps this segment might not be something that you should listen to. And if that is the case, then just skip ahead roughly 7 or 8 minutes from now, give or take a few minutes.
And it will all be over.
And as far as children listening, we will just say,
parental discretion is strongly advised. And so, with all of that having been said, here we go.
Police blotter and court news.
Order! Order!
Criminal court, Jackson County, Kansas City, Missouri, March 17, 1889. Clara Graham, a beautiful girl, 19 years of age, was charged with horse theft and put on trial. She is tall, finely formed, and of unusual intelligence. Miss Graham testified in her own defense. She has a voice like a warm night. When she says hello, it melts all over you, like butter on a hot biscuit. When placed on the stand, she said that on February 13th, while out of work, she had hired a horse and buggy and went for a drive. It was at this point in time, while out, she met Charles McCoy on horseback. He joined her and proposed an elopement, with her to go ahead of him to St. Joseph, while he wrapped up his business matters here in Kansas City so that they would have some money to live on and that he would come and meet up with her shortly afterward. Clara went there, but he did not come on the day that they had agreed to. She waited 3 more days in the hope that Charles was merely delayed, but unfortunately he did not arrive. Clara was now entirely out of money, and in desperation sold the horse and buggy to a family in Horton, Kansas. She also stated that she had acted under the influence of liquor that had been drugged by Mr. McCoy. Miss Graham had been arrested at Troy, Kansas, on the complaint of the Gordon and Schmidt Company, who charged her with stealing the horse and buggy from them. Mr. Gordon testified that she came to their stable on that day and hired the horse and buggy, saying she and the wife of a barber were going to take a drive. She did not name her companion. However, being well-dressed, the horse and buggy were given to her without question. She did not return that night, nor the next day, and Mr. Gordon began a search for her. Miss Graham was traced to West Kansas, and from there to Armordale. From Armordale, she went to St. Joseph, and then drove to Troy. She was finally located near Troy, and arrested on information previously sent out by Mr. Gordon. He traveled to that town on Friday, and she consented to return without requisition, and they arrived here last night. The young lady, as she persistently styled herself, was then placed in a cell. She previously had a magnificent plume of long brown hair, which, however, was cut short to allow the placing over it of a blonde wig, which she wore on the day she got the horse and buggy. Miss Graham has eyes that are so big and blue they make you think of mountain lakes. The men of the jury often seem to be mesmerized by them. Nevertheless, they found her guilty and gave her a sentence of 2 years in prison. She's the only woman ever to be convicted of horse theft in Missouri. Editor's note. A horse thief is about as unpopular a mortal as can be who chooses to enter a life of crime. In the western states, including Missouri, they frequently end up at the end of a rope. A vulgar horse thief is beneath the notice of a high-toned bank burglar or even of a gentlemanly pickpocket. But when the horse thief is a woman and a good-looking one at that, the entire aspect of things is changed. Everybody seeks her attention, and the hard-hearted minions of the law bow down before her, and the jail is rat from top to bottom to find comfortable accommodations. Marshal Hugh McGowan and his deputies are evidently made from the same clay. They have practically fluttered with excitement to assure the satisfaction and contentment of Miss Graham. Update, December 2nd, 1889, Jefferson City, Missouri. Governor David Francis granted a pardon today to Clara Graham, a girl 19 years old, who was convicted last March of horse theft and sentenced to prison for 2 years. That pardon was granted by the governor pursuant to the recommendation of the judge and prosecuting attorney and in consideration of the previous good conduct of the prisoner and also, quote, the promise of her father to keep her home hereafter, unquote. The documents in this case are quite voluminous. Charles McCoy, who is a fugitive from justice, had written a letter to the governor taking the blame and declaring that he had drugged the girl and left her in possession of the horse, which had been taken from a livery stable. The girl's father arrived here today to bring her home.
The court is adjourned.
And that brings us to the end of the police blotter and court news from March 17th, 1889. We hope that this short visit to the dark and dusty trails of yesteryear was an enjoyable and interesting experience for you.
Listeners, in regard to the police blotter, that was a whale of a story.
Definitely a little more dramatic than what we usually feature on the police blotter.
Now, I want to mention one thing that wasn't in the story, but that sort of jumped out at me reading between the lines. I have a feeling that Clara Graham and Charles McCoy had a personal relationship of some type prior to this incident. I think that they might have been working together as a pair of crooks and con artists, and they probably had a romantic relationship as well. However, like I said, none of that was in the story. But if you combine what Clara said at her trial and what McCoy said in his letter to the governor, well, I think it makes sense.
Maybe. I'll have to think about it. Okay, therefore, I have to think more. But honestly, I found it incredibly interesting that it is, or it was, such a heinous crime to steal a horse. And it is really interesting to me how much looks played into this story.
Yes.
And how about that twist ending? She gets pardoned.
She had a 2-year sentence, and it looks like she only served about 6 months.
Again, she was a very pretty girl and young, and I think that had a lot to do with it.
Now, I want to mention, in regard to the Clara Graham story on the police blotter, that when I first stumbled across this story, it was in a very short article from the Associated Press that gave very few details. However, the article made me curious, and I wondered if there might possibly be a little more information in regard to the incident. So I did some searching to see if I could find anything else. And I came across 5 or 6 newspapers that told this very unusual story with very different amounts of detail. But I decided to use the version that you heard narrated on this episode because it had the most information and vivid description.
By the way, according to this article, Clara was 19. However, according to the article from the Associated Press, she was 18, and there was also another article that said she was 20.
But the consensus seems to be that she was 19, especially when you include the news articles from when she was released. And I have no concrete reason to believe anything different.
Now, listeners, here is one more interesting aspect to this story. First, keep in mind that although our guest narrator is female, the reporter who wrote this article in 1889 was male. Now, with that rather important context, this article is a great example of the old saying, "Beauty is in the eye of the beholder," because it is beyond obvious that this reporter thought that Clara Graham was basically gorgeous. For example, in the article, there is a description of Clara as having bright blue eyes that were almost hypnotic. However, a reporter for a different newspaper in a nearby town in Kansas, the Selden Times, wrote an article published on March 28, 1889, that gave a rather different description of Clara. Quote, "She has dark gray eyes and regular features, and while not beautiful, are quite interesting." Unquote. I don't know what to say.
Kit, I have a question, and I'd like your honest opinion. This is a question that occurred to me while I was preparing for this episode. In the present day, we often hear the word privilege. Basically, the concept that some people get favors or advantages in the workplace, in courts, and elsewhere in everyday life on the basis of skin color or wealth. Now, here is my question. Do you think that being attractive is a type of privilege? And by that, I mean, do you think that in the present day, people who are physically attractive tend to get favors or advantages that most people don't? I mean, for years and years, there has been a stereotype that a pretty girl can smile her way out of a traffic ticket, or can get a job, or a promotion, or an extension of a deadline, etc., etc. Now, do you think that stereotype is true in the present?
Well, I definitely think that stereotype is still true in the present day. I think that women get, especially gorgeous women, get a lot of different things for free. I know of a lot of girls who will go into a bar and not have to pay anything if they are gorgeous, because guys will just buy them drinks. And I think it's the same way with anything else.
Listeners, as you obviously know, podcasting is not a visual medium. But I really wish that it was, because then you would know that Kit Caron definitely fits into the category of people who are able to get free drinks.
Hey, it's my superpower. I'm just kidding. And on that note, we will move on. We would like to express our deepest thanks to our guest narrator and our guest voices on the Police Blotter segment. Please take a bow with social distancing from each other and tell our listeners a little about yourselves.
Hey, y'all. Jessica here. Here to remind you, if your podcast, radio show, or voiceover requires a sweet Texas twang, you can always reach me at iamtexasjess@gmail.com or xoxojessicaxoxo on all social media platforms.
I'm J.D. Sutter, founder of Porchlight Family Media, a production studio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we produce family-friendly podcasts and other audio programming.
Skyflower, podcast enthusiast and fan of the show.
Thank you, Jessica, for your terrific narration, as well as the other guest voices. Absolutely excellent work.
Yes, many thanks. You did an awesome job.
Now, listeners, we would very much like to be able to tell police blotter stories from the 19th century newspapers of your city or town.
So, if you have the time and ability, just send it to us by email and we promise to use it as soon as we can. The address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
And thank you for doing that.
Next, we will move on to our recommendations and advice segment. Jim and I will each take a few moments to mention something that we think our listeners might be interested in hearing about. It might be a book, a movie, a TV show, a podcast, an app, a game, a food, a recipe, a product, a life hack, or who knows? It will always be something different. By the way, we want our listeners to know that Jim and I do not synchronize or discuss our comments or suggestions in regard to this segment before we record. That way, it's always a surprise for the listeners and for us. And on this episode, Jim will give you his recommendation first, and then I will give you mine.
Okay, listeners, for my recommendation, I'm going to suggest that you go online and try out a few old-time radio programs. For example, if you like mystery stories, especially mysteries with twist endings, try out The Mysterious Traveler or The Whistler. If you like stories that are similar to The Twilight Zone, check out Theater 5. If you like comedy, there's plenty of that. For example, you might like The Mayor of the Town, a very funny series which stars Lionel Barrymore as a small-town mayor. If you like stand-up comedy or sketch comedy, try out the Jack Benny program, the Fred Allen program, or Duffy's Tavern. And the shows I've just mentioned are just a few examples. And you might remember we have had a few episodes of this podcast that have revolved around old-time radio shows of one type or another, and to one degree or another. I happened to be thinking about that the other day, and so with that in mind, if I've generated any interest on your part, here is all that you need to do. Just go on Google and type the letters OTR, followed by the name of the show that you want to listen to. For example, OTR and then The Mysterious Traveler, The Whistler, Theater 5, or any other show that you want to try. You'll be surprised at just how great those shows are. And by that, I mean great acting and great writing, as far as stories and plots. Now, one last thing in regard to looking for old-time radio shows. If you want to check out old-time radio for free, just look around and you'll find one or more websites that offer free downloadable episodes of whatever show you're interested in. Sometimes every episode of any given show, all for free. Especially if you find a page that is connected to an organization called Old Time Radio Researchers. And on any of those pages, look for the MP3 button. Click on that and check out the available episodes of any show that you've decided to try. But be careful, because there are some websites that are selling CDs or digital copies of this or that show. So, that's my recommendation, Old Time Radio. The audio quality is surprisingly good, and it's amazing how well the stories hold up in the present day. So, go check it out the next time you're bored and looking for something different to do or to listen to.
Thank you, Jim.
Now,
on this episode, I would like to recommend a show that's been running for, 14 years? Or 14 seasons, which is, I don't know how many years. But Supernatural, it is a really, really interesting show with all of, demons and angels and ghosts and Lucifer and, well, if you like stuff like that, Sam and Dean, the characters in the show, they play brothers and they're monster hunters. You should definitely check it out. And you will get hooked and want to binge, and you will have a bunch of TV because, again, there are 14 seasons. It's on Netflix, and as you can tell, I have Netflix because a lot of my recommendations are from Netflix. Or you can find them on Netflix. And I don't think that we have any other recommendations or suggestions for our listeners on this episode. But listeners, If you have a suggestion for something that you would like us to mention on this segment, just send us an email. And if it's a good recommendation, we will pass it along to the members of our audience. Next, moving along, we would once again ask you, our wonderful listeners, to take a moment when this episode is over and go to iTunes, then rate, review, and subscribe to the Forgotten News Podcast.
It helps to bring new listeners to the podcast and gives us a bump in the rankings on iTunes.
However, for the duration of the current crisis, we are only allowing 5-star reviews, for obvious reasons.
We are sure that you understand.
Plus, getting nice reviews definitely helps motivate us to keep producing new episodes. So, thanks in advance for your ratings and reviews. We'd also appreciate getting your feedback.
Give us your comments, suggestions, ideas, thoughts, and anything you might like to say in regard to this episode, or any of our past episodes, or mini-episodes.
Or about the show in general. We really sincerely like hearing from our listeners. So, with that in mind, our email address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
We are also on Facebook and Twitter.
Just type Forgotten News Podcast into the search box and you can find us.
But on Twitter, our handle is @newsforgotten, not Forgotten News.
Now, if you would like to contact me on Twitter, my handle is @KitKaren, spelled @KitCaren, as if it were all one word. You can feel free to tweet at me anytime. Or you can slide into my DMs. In case you have questions that you want to ask me, or any secrets that you want to tell me. But nothing nasty and nothing nude. Just be nice. That's all I ask. Just be nice. And I'll reply. I promise. So, anyway, please feel free to use any of those methods to interact with us.
Now, moving on.
Nope, there is no moving on. That's it. We've covered everything. There is nothing else on the agenda.
Okay. I get it.
We need to go. We've got things to do.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening. And tell your friends. Get them to listen.
Yeah, for sure. The more the merrier.
Yes. And we definitely hope that we have given you a few minutes of distraction from all the stress in the world right now.
I feel it's my duty to help you relieve all this tension you're feeling. Bye, everyone. Wash your hands. And remember, history is no mystery.
Thank you for listening to the Forgotten News Podcast. You will now be returned back to the present day, and we hope that we can count on you to join us for our next episode.
If you can hold tragedy in your heart and comedy in your head, then you can rest assured that you are sane.